Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Thank you for joining us on The Change Artist, where we bring our listeners stories and great advice for leading and following through change, from business leaders who are making a difference in their organizations. I'm your host, Alyssa Cox, and here on The Change Artist, our motto is, if change is the only constant in life, then let's do it better. My guest today is Christy Ashwanden, science journalist and author of Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. And she's with us today to talk about the Finkbeiner test and how what we choose or choose not to say or write about plays a role in driving change. So Christy, tell us about the Finkbeiner test. What is it? And how did you get involved with it?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to thank you. This is so fortuitous. So it turns out I was looking for some links to send to you about the Finkbeiner test. And that is how I discovered that it was exactly 10 years ago today that Anne Finkbeiner posted her blog post on Last Word on Nothing that would become the Finkbeiner test. So that was kind of an exciting revelation to me. So I'll just back up for a moment and tell you a little bit more. I'm the member of this group science blog called Last Word on Nothing. The title actually comes from a Victor Hugo quote that says, science says the first word on everything and the last word on nothing. So a lot of people wonder where that comes from. But back in 2013, 10 years ago, my Last Word on Nothing colleague, Anne Finkbeiner, wrote this blog post basically talking about this story she wasn't going to write. Well, Anne is a really super esteemed and well-known science writer. She has a lot of beats. She's written numerous books on a variety of topics. But one of her beats is astronomy. And she had been assigned by a very prominent science magazine to write about a female astronomer. And she just sort of had it. So she wrote this blog post about all the things she was not going to write about. And so she listed all these things she wasn't going to mention. She basically said she wanted to write about an impressive astronomer and not once mention that she's a woman. And so some of the things she wasn't going to mention are, first of all, of course, that she's a woman. Second, her husband's job, her childcare arrangements, how she nurtures her underlings, how she was taken aback by the competitiveness of her field, how she's a role model for other women, how she's the first woman to, you know, there's all of these profiles of women who, oh, she's the first woman to do this or the first woman to do that. And Anne just said, you know, I'm tired of this. And I really, yeah, I read the post by Anne and it really resonated with me. And I thought, yeah, this is brilliant. This is what we need to do. What we can do is instead of fighting this and saying, you know, we don't want to do this, let's just stop doing it. Let's just stop using gender as like this meta context and the most important thing, you know, when we're writing about women in their fields. And yeah, I think it was really a way of refusing to engage in this sort of belittling language that's so often used to describe women in science. And so instead of saying, we're going to, you know, make a big deal out of not doing that, or we're going to keep telling, we're just going to stop doing it. We're just going to stop, full stop. Let's just quit. We'll just pretend that sexism is over. We've moved on. We don't need to keep making every single story about that.
If we pretend sexism is over, how do we then attack the sexism that's not over?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a common misperception. So I need to back up for a second and say, so I read Anne's post and I thought, I want to make this into something bigger than just this post. And so I modeled this on the Bechdel test, which you've probably heard of. This is named after the comic strip writer, Alison Bechdel. She's a wonderful, wonderful cartoonist and also a writer. She's written some wonderful books, but she had this Bechdel test. It's a really simple test actually for sexism and women's representation in film. And it's just the Bechdel test is super simple. To pass it, you have to answer yes to this. Does it feature at least two women talking to each other about something other than a man? And it's ridiculous how simple and like seemingly silly this is, and yet how many films fail that test. And so I thought that was really brilliant. And so the Finkbeiner test is kind of a version of that. You know, I think one misperception about the Finkbeiner test is that it's an attempt to just silence sexism and to just pretend that it doesn't exist. And that's not what we're saying at all. This isn't like saying, you know, let's just pretend that everyone's all the same. But the real intention here is to stop using that kind of sexist framing of subjects and to stop using these gendered contexts in which to describe people. So you can describe her science, you can describe the way that she she operates her lab. You can describe all of these things without making her gender front and center. And I think that's really the intention that we had here, was to make people stop and think about how language really can put people within the confines of certain gender stereotypes.
And then how do we think about the language we choose to use or not use as part of a change we're trying to drive, right? Does the language that we choose to use or to not use drive change from your perspective, or is it sort of a lagging indicator of change that's already happening in the marketplace?
You know, I think it can be both. I think we've seen this in a lot of other instances. So now one thing that immediately comes to mind is the use of pronouns. So people stating their pronouns, and that was a change. And that was really, you know, an effort to be more inclusive and to make it, you know, to stop stigmatizing the use of, you know, people telling people, you know, sharing their pronouns and things like that. And I think just the fact that at first it may feel awkward to some people, it seems strange because you're in the process of that social change happening. And I think in a lot of ways, the Finkbeiner test is the same way. What it's really done is it's given people a framework with which to think about and talk about sexism in science. And it's given them, you know, a lot of people have argued about the Finkbeiner test, and that's fine. I mean, we welcome feedback and all of that. Although I feel like Anne and I are both somewhat militant about defending it and defending the idea, I think we're both open to ideas about it. And we certainly aren't saying that every single thing needs to pass this. I mean, if you're writing a biography of a female scientist, of course, you're going to mention some of the things on our list. But really, the main thing here is to really think about, okay, why am I mentioning, you know, this woman's husband right here? Is that something that's relevant? Is the first introduction to a female scientist going to be, here, let us introduce you to the wife of so-and-so? Like, no, yes, she may have a husband, and that's fine, and it's okay to mention him. But her identity should not be as a wife in that context. That is a different topic. And it's really about making people stop and think about, if I'm doing something that violates the test, is there a justification for it? Is it justified? Is there a reason? And, you know, the Finkbeiner test really, I think, took off and gained its fame because shortly after I wrote the test, The New York Times wrote this extremely sexist obituary of this brilliant, I mean, she was literally a rocket scientist, Yvonne Brill. And the lead was, she made a mean beef stroganoff, followed her husband from job to job, and took 8 years off from work to raise 3 children. You know, and those are all wonderful things. They're great accomplishments. I have no doubt that she was a great mother and wife, and those are all fine things to say. But the reason that her obituary was in the New York Times was that she was a brilliant rocket scientist, and that should be the first paragraph. You know, the survivors and whatnot, that can come in the last paragraph. And, you know, the Times got a ton of pushback about this, and this really, because the Finkbeiner test was so new, it helped it rise to prominence. You know, it's now featured in Wikipedia and a lot of other things. I mean, I've done numerous podcast interviews about it. It's been written about. And I think what's really happened is this has sort of helped start a conversation. And I think that's really good. It's not going to be the be all and end all. It's not going to solve sexism, but I think it offers people a way to talk about it. And I really had an interesting experience one time. I was teaching at a journalism conference, and one of the instructors brought up a profile of a female scientist that had run in that day's New York Times. And the lead was actually incredibly sexist. I can't remember now what it was, but it was, you know, it started with something about her appearance and her being pretty or something like that. And I was sitting there, of course I noticed this, but one of the students in the class actually raised her hand and said, "Hey, have you heard of the Finkbeiner test? Because this story really fails it. And, you know, I'm disappointed that you're raising this story, you know, as an example of what we should be aspiring to." I was there as another instructor, but I wasn't teaching this particular session. And it was great. It really pleased me to see that this started a conversation, and it gave someone, you know, that story made me feel uncomfortable. I immediately felt like it was sort of sexist, but the Finkbeiner test sort of made it easier to talk about that and to look at and sort of assess the ways in which it was wrong or what were some of the problems with it. And I think at the end of the day, that's what the Finkbeiner test has really done best, is really created a language and created a framework for thinking about this stuff and talking about it and looking at it out in the world.
And so if the Finkbeiner test is then a framework for thinking about the kind of change and maybe even elucidating the root cause need for change, mm-hmm. and shapes the way we should think about productive communications in the future around female scientists, it's only part of the equation, right? And so what are the other communication vehicles that we use to talk about the necessary change that perhaps are not, I hate to say omission of gender from science writing, but there is, I think, a focus on science and a focus on non-gendered contribution. How do we pair that removal of gender with a conversation that is very gender forward and proactive around balancing the playing field from a gender perspective?
Yeah. And I think it's important to note that we're not saying that gender can never be talked about or that you have to be silent and you can't divulge someone's gender, whatever it may be. But I think what we're really talking about is removing those gender stereotypes, which are almost like sort of pigeonholes. So taking people out of those and letting them sort of be in the world as they are. And, you know, those personal details can be telling details, but writing about them, you know, for example, the Yvonne Brill obituary, which talked about how she took off all this time to go raise her kids. Well, that's interesting in the context of, you know, why did she do that? Well, because our society has this expectation that women are the child raisers and that they need to do that. And so it really says more about our society than it says about her, right? I mean, it says that she was able to overcome that. But, you know, we need to look at sort of the context of this. And so you're talking about her needing to make these sort of compromises in order to continue her career, but that she was able to succeed anyway. But sort of taking that out from being something like it's a personal triumph to her to where this is like a problem with society that we should think about addressing. And so you can talk about her science and the brilliance of it and all of the great work that she did, but it shouldn't always just be completely overshadowed by all of these things that we're trying to push her down to, if that makes sense. And I think some of it is just, you know, removing this expectation, like, well, we have to address what kind of mother she was, and we have to address, like, you know, what she did. You know, did she go home and make dinner for her husband? You know, if we can remove all that and just let people be in the world as they are, instead of looking at them always through the lens of gender, that makes any sense.
It does. It makes a lot of sense. And so are you seeing over the 10 years that the Finkbeiner test has been out in the world, are you seeing improvements in the way people are writing about female scientists, either as a function of the Finkbeiner test or using the Finkbeiner test to measure other movements in sort of our sociocultural approach to gender in the sciences?
Yeah, I think I have seen change. You know, it hasn't solved the problem. I wish something like this could be that powerful. But what I have seen is that I think it's gotten people looking at it and talking about it a little bit more. I think that you couldn't publish an obit like that one of Yvonne Brill again right now. And I actually saw the other day when I was looking up something about the Finkbeiner test that actually Radiolab had done a rerun of an old show, and they had actually appended to the show notes an apology stating that they had amended and actually re-edited the beginning of that particular episode because it had originally started by introducing this scientist as the wife of someone, and they realized, oh, this fails the Finkbeiner test, and this isn't right. We don't need to be introducing her as someone's wife. Like, that's really inappropriate. And so I think, you know, seeing things like that make me feel like, yeah, this is making a difference, and it is making people pause and take a step back and ask, you know, is this really the best way to do this?
And what about for you personally? Have you found that your narrative or your language has changed? Has it brought front and center for you, perhaps unconscious ways that you had been using a dominant narrative that was gendered, and perhaps now you're able to sort of isolate and move on and change the way you communicate?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing it's really done is made me really think about, you know, again, I just want to emphasize that the intention here wasn't to stop people from writing about sexism in science, but I think what it's made me do is make sure that when I am writing about it, so instead of writing about a story that she was the first woman to do X, Y, and Z, like this is some triumph for her, which it absolutely is, but the issue here is that there's a problem that she had to overcome, and that problem should be addressed from, you know, society. So we have this tendency to sort of blame the victim, and it's like it's her responsibility to overcome this vast hurdle that's this institutional sexism that people have to overcome. And so I really strive to, when I'm writing about this stuff, really look at the bigger picture and to sort of stop making it an individual problem to solve. So like if someone I'm writing about is facing institutionalized sexism, sort of not making it on them to like solve it or not, or like, you know, well, you can overcome it or not. And that may be the situation in the world, but to really sort of hold those greater forces accountable. Because the only way that we're going to solve these issues is by looking at them in a systematic and big picture way and solving, you know, the institutional problems. This isn't something that is generally solved on an individual basis.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of parallels between what you're talking about and work that I see in other areas, perhaps racially centric areas of the DE&I movement, around not putting the burden of overcoming racism on the people who are being victimized.
Exactly. And also it's sort of not making people not tokenizing them, you know, like you're, oh, here's the woman, she did it. Look, there's no sexism here to see, you know, it really, and I think that's part of the reason we really, you know, the Finkbeiner says like, let's stop making it the first woman to, sure, that can be a fact. It can be an important thing. It may be impressive, but the thing that's impressive about it is not that, you know, no other woman has done it. That says something about the institution or whatever it is that was holding women back. By saying that, you're almost reinforcing the thing like, well, women can't really do this except for her. She was really great, you know?
And I like this idea about writing or communicating with purpose and then thinking about if you understand your purpose for communications, then being really intentional with the details that you share to support that purpose, right? And so if your purpose is to highlight overcoming institutional barriers to achievement, then you might choose a different set of things to talk about than if your purpose is to highlight scientific achievement, for example. If we're talking about scientific achievement, let's talk about achievements in the sciences and bringing that intentionality to the details that we choose to share.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And so how do we disaster recover here?
Yeah.
If you have identified a time where you have perhaps not communicated with purpose or allowed the details that you share not to align to your purpose, you've failed the Finkbeiner test and you can see it in retrospect. Mm-hmm. How do you move forward, or what do you recommend we do as we move forward to try to recover that particular piece of communication?
Yeah. You know, maybe with a few exceptions, I don't want to go back and flog people who've made mistakes in the past. I mean, I think this is really about moving forward. You know, we do want to correct mistakes that happened and not perpetuate them. You know, I've been a science journalist for 25 years. I'm sure that you can find something in my back catalog that fails the Finkbeiner test. And, you know, we could talk about that and I would feel bad, but I think it's really about looking forward and saying, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. And that's no longer acceptable. It wasn't acceptable then, but just that, you know, I'm going to hold myself to a higher standard now.
Yeah, because I think that part of the challenge that I see and that I see others experience in the DE&I space is we all bring unconscious bias that we're becoming more and more aware of. We all screw it up at some point.
Yeah.
And so what do you do when you screw it up? How do you recover in the moment? Because what you've said is actually not reflective of what you were trying to communicate or reflective of your intentions.
Yeah.
Right. How do you go and talk through, I said this thing yesterday, I recognize it was not communicating what I was intending and I'd like to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, I think the Radiolab apology is a really good example. They said, hey, wait, we went back and we saw that we made a mistake here and we've corrected it, but we're telling you that we've corrected it. We feel bad and we're not going to do that again. And we're really, you know, learned something from it. I think that's a really appropriate way to do it. And I think, you know, that's the way to move forward. You know, but I think that those apologies have to be genuine and they can't just be like, oh no, we got caught out, you know, time to cover our butts. You know, it can't be that kind of apology, or that it can't be the I'm sorry if anyone was offended. Like, that's not, again, you don't put it on the person that you've wronged. You take responsibility. And, you know, I think the other thing is the best way to show your intentions is through your actions. And so the more that you can align your actions with your values and your intentions, the better off you'll be, because it rings pretty hollow when people are saying, oh, that's not what we meant. And yet they continue to do this bad behavior, right? And it's like, you can do that once and ask for an apology, but you can't continue it. And so then I think the way forward, then you make that mistake, you apologize for it, but then you make damn sure you don't make that mistake again.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're coming up on the end of time. If people want to learn more about the work that you do, the writing that you do, or your work on the ThinkBinder test, how should they go about finding out more?
Yeah, so I have a couple of ways that people can find me. My website is kristiashwanden.com. That's my name. Last Word on Nothing is where the ThinkBinder test originated. So if you Google Last Word on Nothing and ThinkBinder test, you'll find a lot of good stuff there. You can also see there's a Wikipedia entry about the ThinkBinder test that's actually pretty good and pretty accurate. So that's good. I am also the host of a podcast about creative process called Emerging Form, and you can find that at emergingform.substack.com. I used to be on Twitter. I've left that place for various reasons, Elon Musk, the first among them. But you can find me on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Craig Crest, C-R-A-G-C-R-E-S-T. I'm also on Mastodon.
Great. We will be sure to include those links and those websites in the show notes so people can follow your work and reach out to learn more. Kristi, I really appreciate your time and your perspective here. I know I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have as well. And hopefully our listeners can take your advice and apply it to their own teams. Now, if any of our listeners would like to bring these kinds of conversations to their own organizations, you can visit us at Blue Swift Consulting to learn more. Thank you so much, Kristi. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.